This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Here it comes.
The storm never seen before. Angel City fire. Prophets from the satellite, students of the deep. To disturb you in the dream.
When summer comes in winter, is that a problem? Sure, there's a flood of bad news. We may be hurting in our minds, sore in our hearts, but we can't let this pass. Why was the American West so hot? Hotter than anyone's ever seen. Hotter than even doomers believed possible in March. We explore this historic heat event with the weathermaster, meteorologist Jeff Masters. Then large system specialist Deirdre Desjardins uses AI tools to discover a chain of forces from the hot Pacific Ocean through Hawaii flooding right to the western droughts, disappearing snowpack, and the prospects for this summer. Both science and news reports confirm a regime shift in the atmosphere, complete with blocking patterns holding extreme weather that pops up around the world. Are you ready for the big truth? I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Why did 14 states of the American West get summer in March? Was the U.S. heat dome related to floods in Hawaii and Canada? What just happened here? If you want the true record, you want Jeff Masters and friends. One of the original NOAA hurricane hunters, meteorologist Jeff Masters, co-founded the Weather Underground and now contributes to Yale Climate Connections. From Michigan, Jeff Masters, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Your recent piece at Climate Connections is titled Mind-Blowing March Heatwave Crests. You've seen a lot of weather in your career. Why is this specific event stopping you in your tracks?
It's the timing of it more than anything. March is a very unusual time to get summer-like heat because the sun just isn't up as high as it is in the heat of summer. And we had definite summer-like temperatures. I mean, temperatures over 100 for consecutive days in Phoenix. We had the all-time March heat record for the entire country beaten not only on four straight days, but beaten by a large margin. It used to be 108 degrees, and we had a couple stations hit 112 during this heat wave. So the timing and the intensity and the length, this was a 10-day-long heat wave, and the breadth as well. I mean, this covered most of the western U.S. We had 17 states set their all-time March heat record during this heat wave. So all these factors together make it simply extraordinary, something that I've only seen one other time in my career, and that was back in 2021 when we had a summer heat wave in June in the Pacific Northwest and Canada.
But why did it just sit there? I mean, usually weather moves along from west to east, but this didn't.
That's a great question. I mean, we can trace the intensity of the heat wave to climate change, making these extremes hotter, but you also need a dynamic contribution. The jet stream has to cooperate, has to get stuck in place for a long period of time to let the heat build. And we're less sure about what the climate change connection might be to that particular event. The jet stream normally just keeps progressing from west to east, carrying along high and low pressure systems with it. But if the jet stream gets stuck in a very contorted position and doesn't budge for multiple days, then you get long periods of extreme weather. Heat, if it happens to be you got high pressure over you, or storms, if you happen to have low pressure over you, like happened in Hawaii during this same event. So the climate models just have a lot of trouble simulating that in the current climate. I mean, they don't really do a good job forecasting when these blocks are going to occur. So figuring out how climate change might affect these blocks, that's almost an impossibility because the climate change models simply don't handle the current situation very well.
And people just weren't ready for this. People were debating whether to put snow shovels away or whatever, and this hit. They didn't have their cooling centers ready in Phoenix as they would have had it come in the summertime. And I have to wonder, it probably caught a lot of plants off guard as well. I haven't heard about that yet, but I that must happen.
The big risk is if we get killing frost after this, because we had almost as intense heat wave here in Michigan in March 2012, where we had a week straight of 80 degrees Fahrenheit. And after that, I mean, April came and we had more seasonable April weather with lots of killing frost, and it just wiped out the cherry crop, the berry crops. And that's a risk for the western U.S. here, because April is a very cold month in a lot of cases. And we're going to risk these plants coming out way too early and being susceptible to freezing temperatures.
Yeah, the buds on my pear trees are all fat and ready to come out and flower, and now it's well below freezing at night, so we'll see what happens. What did the heat dome mean for the snowpack that can determine summer water downstream for a lot of states?
We're seeing a record crash in the amount of water stored in snowpack in the Rocky Mountains, both in the headwaters of the Colorado River, which supplies water to Arizona and surrounding states, and also in the snowpack from California up into Oregon. When we did get precipitation this year, it tended to fall as rain, not as snow, so we started off in a bad situation. And getting this heat wave, when we did, and how intense it was, means that what little snow we had is on its way out. And it's going to be a situation where we have less than 50% of the normal water we're used to seeing this summer flowing into the reservoirs from the mountains, just because we don't have so much snowpack. And that's going to impact water supplies for cities, for people, for agriculture. And it's also going to make the wildfire season a real humdinger this year, I'm afraid.
I suppose lots of people did enjoy their lovely break of warm weeks. I would. It's t-shirt weather. Should we be nervous?
I think we should, because this sort of extreme is difficult for a lot of systems to deal with, both human and natural. I mean, we evolved to the climate of the 20th century, and now the 21st century is throwing these curveballs at us. That's going to cause hardships, particularly, like I mentioned, with water supply. The wildfire season, we're going to see a lot of wildfire smoke episodes this summer because of it. Wildfire smoke kills between 24,000 and 41,000 Americans each year. And that sort of cost is a massive cost for us to bear. If you look at the dollar cost of that sort of death toll, that's like 1% of GDP. So a lot of reasons to be concerned about it, and climate change could be throwing more of these events at us in the future. I mean, we already saw one in 2021, like I was mentioning, in the Pacific Northwest. Now here we have 5 years later, one just as extreme, just absolutely insane meteorologically. I looked at both these events when they were happening and said, no, it can't be. You know, we're getting temperatures unheard of, 121 in Canada in that one June heat wave in 2021, 112 in Arizona in March during the last week's heat wave. Absolute insanity. So more insanity probably to come, courtesy of climate change.
Well, there you've heard it. The news before the news. We will hear more about all this summer, no doubt. So a World Weather Attribution Study, that's a group of international scientists, they found the Western Heat Dome was virtually impossible without human-induced climate change. Are a lot of people aware of that, the real role of climate change behind what just happened?
I think a lot of people are aware of it because particularly old people, I mean, if you've been around for decade after decade, you know that this is not normal. And we're really not even in a new normal because things are changing so quickly. So people are aware of it if they tend to be older, I think. But unfortunately, our ability to attribute things to climate change is limited. These tools that we have, like World Weather Attribution does, they can say part of what climate change may be doing, but the jet stream shenanigans that are going on, we're less sure about. And I'm pretty sure that we're seeing a significant impact from climate change causing disruption to basic atmospheric circulation patterns that are helping cause these sorts of events. Yeah, you can say, well, the planet's a degree or two warmer, so that boosts the temperature of this heat wave. But it's the actual circulation changes that accompany climate change that we have less confidence in being able to say what climate change is doing. That's where things are really starting to get crazy. And I'm confident that we're seeing a massive contribution from climate change in some of these stuck jet stream patterns causing these incredible extremes.
And this heat dome arrived as the western states were already going through a long, long drought. And I was surprised to find that heat, not lack of precipitation, is driving U.S. droughts. That was in a NOAA research paper published November 2024. Jeff Masters, does that suggest that simple greenhouse warming could lead to more drought years, like a drying of the West?
Absolutely. The West is in a mega drought that's unprecedented in hundreds of years. And a lot of that is not because of lack of precipitation, like you were mentioning. It's just the fact that the climate has warmed. When you warm up the air, you make plants thirstier. They lose more moisture to the atmosphere, and that dries out the soil and it makes them more susceptible to dying off. So it's that thirstiness of the plants that is an unavoidable result of human-caused climate change that's really driving drought now. Yeah, there are some regions that are getting less precipitation, and some of that is apparent in the desert southwest, but it's really hotter temperatures that are driving drought conditions now. And the U.S. is in serious shape this year for drought. We've got more than half the country in drought right now. The forecast for April's not looking very wet. It's looking average to below average, so we're really going to have a multi-billion dollar drought impact this year with a lot of wildfires.
Now, in mid-March 2026, back-to-back Kona lows delivered some of the worst flooding Hawaii has seen in decades. We had destructive winds, flash flooding, evacuations, rescues, major infrastructure damage. Jeff, what is a Kona low, and what makes them different from tropical cyclones or hurricanes? Are they different?
They are different. They're very wet, so they have that in common with tropical cyclones, but they're cold weather sorts of phenomena. They have a lot of cold air aloft that helps feed the storm, make it stronger. It's just a fundamentally different energy source than a hurricane. But the result is the same. When a Kona low gets stuck in place, like happened back in mid-March, then it's going to dump wave after wave of precipitation. And the reason they're called Kona is because the Kona side of Hawaii is the west side. That's the side that's usually dry. And in this case, the precipitation is coming from the opposite direction it usually does, which is a problem because, you know, the dry side is not as adapted to heavy rains as the wet side, the eastern side of the Hawaiian Islands. So this Kona low system was actually part of the same stuck jet stream pattern that brought the heat wave to the desert southwest. Everything got jammed up in a big traffic jam. The low pressure stayed stuck over Hawaii. The high pressure got stuck over the western U.S. And both of those areas were subject to unprecedented extremes, just of the opposite kind.
So we may really be looking at just one big event.
It was one big event. And there were some other stuck jet stream patterns going on worldwide at that time. I know in Asia they had really insane heat waves going on, too, where they were breaking all-time records by 30 degrees Fahrenheit. So extremes going on globally in this case, we just didn't hear about them as much over in Asia because, well, we had plenty to pay attention to here in the U.S.
And meanwhile, we had a long atmospheric river strike British Columbia in mid-March. We had heavy rains, high winds, floods, landslides. Are there any connections between that and the heat dome just to the south?
Absolutely. That atmospheric river that was hitting the Pacific Northwest and British Columbia was attached to the Kona low over Hawaii. So sometimes we call that the Pineapple Express. You get a moisture conduit flowing directly from the subtropics near Hawaii up into the Northwest, delivering all that heavy precipitation. Moreover, that intense precipitation that was falling, when water condenses, water, I'm sorry, when water vapor condenses, it releases heat. It's the original heat energy that went into evaporating it in the first place. We call it latent heat. And now heat is energy. And this atmospheric river was pushing all that heat that was released from Hawaii up into the Pacific Northwest and Vancouver area. And that heat energy went directly into feeding the intensity of the ridge of high pressure over the western U.S. So you had a situation where a storm was helping drive a heat wave and a drought. The heat from the storm, which was augmented by climate change and global warming, making ocean temperatures warmer and providing extra heat energy, that extra heat went directly into both the storms and into the heat wave.
Yes, I wanted to raise that. Talk about the role of sustained heat in the North Pacific Ocean in all this March weather madness.
We're familiar with heat waves over land, but we get what are called marine heat waves, too. And they tend to be longer lasting because the ocean has a longer memory. It doesn't warm up or cool down as rapidly as the land does. So when you do get a lot of warm water, it's going to disrupt atmospheric circulation patterns. And that's part of why this jet stream got stuck in place during this heat wave, was because of a marine heat wave going on, altering the jet stream pattern. Now, what we have going on because of the heat wave in the southwest U.S. is the adjacent waters got superheated. We're talking about June levels of heat now in the waters off of California, Southern California, Gulf of Mexico, or Gulf of California, and that's going to affect things this summer. You got all that warm water right offshore. It's going to contribute to heavy rainfall events inland, and we've seen that in the past, particularly over Death Valley. They had record flooding a few years ago when we had very, very warm ocean temperatures right offshore there. So we're at risk of extreme flooding this summer because of all that hot water off of the coast from the heat wave in March.
But if the North Pacific is strangely warm and it's providing more moisture into the atmosphere, why isn't that rain reaching the western states that need it in their drought?
That's the way it goes with the atmosphere. It has preferential patterns of the storm track gets it set in a certain place, and one area will get hammered after time following the jet stream as it pulls these low-pressure systems along it, whereas other parts of the country just get avoided. And we're seeing that with the drought pattern in the U.S. right now. The center of the country is actually doing pretty well for rain, places like from Missouri up into Michigan, the center of the country. And that's the way the storm track's going. But the southwestern part of the country and the southeastern part, Florida's in record drought now too. So the storm track is basically going from the Pacific Northwest, bulging down into the central U.S., Missouri, Arkansas, then bowing back up north in Michigan, Ontario, but avoiding the southwest U.S., Texas, it's avoiding Florida, Mississippi, and Alabama have wildfires right now. And the East Coast is also in drought, quite dry. Storm track is missing them. So it's just one of those things. The jet stream likes to set up in a particular pattern, and it gets stuck in these sorts of long-term situations that encourage drought in one area and then right adjacent to it, flooding.
As we speak, everyone from heads of state to YouTube influencers say they are losing sleep over the sudden shutoff of fossil fuels from the Persian Gulf. Now governments are recommending what climate watchers called for all along, little things like ride sharing, fly less, adjust your thermostat. Is there an intersection between your decades of weather and climate reporting and this sudden oil and gas shock? Do you have thoughts on it?
You know, it's kind of, we've been pushing forever for a carbon tax to make fossil fuels more expensive, to really put them in their place as far as the costs that they generate. I mean, all this extreme weather we're getting now has costs it's imposing on our economy, and those costs are not being borne by the fossil fuel industry, which they should be. So here we are. We're getting a tax, just not the way we envisioned it. Fossil fuels are getting more expensive, and in that sense, it would be a good thing if it pushes more investment in renewable energy. Yeah, it's sad to see it happen like this. I mean, you hate to see a war causing more people to go to renewable energy, but let's take that victory if we can get it.
As we wrap up here, in your mind, Jeff, is that Great March Heat Dome we talked about, is it a historic event, or is it just an introduction to the new normal?
It's absolutely a historic event. I've got a post coming up in a few days called The 5 Most Extreme Weather Events of the 21st Century, and this event ranks up there. As far as, it's kind of a subjective thing, things that impressed me as being, whoa, I didn't ever expect to see that in my lifetime. The other events I might mention that made that list are, of course, the 2021 heat event that I mentioned, the 2012 heat event here in Michigan that I mentioned, and also a Russian heat wave back in 2010 that actually made bread prices go up to the point where the Arab Spring happened, revolt in multiple countries in Africa, overthrowing their governments because of this heat wave that caused a drought that caused grain prices to grow up. And finally, the Hurricane Sandy of 2012 is my final event for the list. So this event ranks up there, really incredible meteorologic event that just left me stunned.
The 2010 Russian heat wave was just amazing. I covered it at the time. And also on the flip side of it, just like the weather we've been talking about, there were massive floods in Pakistan at the same time. So it was split into a wet part and a hot part, just as we just experienced. But I'm surprised that you would not count the 2003 heat wave in Europe that killed possibly 50 or 60,000 people.
That was the deadliest heat wave in history, and I was not following that as closely. I didn't start blogging on the weather until 2005, so that heat wave predated my attention spans. So this is a very subjective list I came up with based on things I've been following since 2005. So maybe I should qualify that most intense since 2005.
We've both been blogging since 2005, and that's quite amazing. We've been speaking with one of the best weather watchers and historians in America, I think. He's teamed up with Bob Henson and Christopher Burt. They capture big stories as they happen, like mind-blowing March heat wave crests, records melt from Arizona to Minnesota. Find links to all that in my show blog at ecoshock.org and check out yaleclimateconnections.org. Jeff, thank you so much for making time for our listeners.
Welcome, Alex. Good to talk.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
When summer comes in winter, we are in big trouble. It happened this year in the American West and Mexico. Hot summer days in Denver and over 100 degrees, 38°C in Phoenix. We're just beginning to understand how this happened and what it means. Is winter broken? Over the last 16 years, Deirdre Desjardins has studied science and tech on California water issues and climate change. As giant heat domes appear across the world, Deirdre explains this latest out-of-season heat blister in her blog, and she does it really well. She is the director of California Water Research. From California, Deirdre Desjardins, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's great to be on, and yeah, what a March we've had.
That was my first question. What was March like where you were this year?
It was really warm, and the sea surface temperatures off Scripps Pier in Southern California spiked to above summer maximum levels. And it was just I live in Santa Cruz, so it wasn't as hot on the coast, but there were temperatures broken all over.
Well, what do you think made that Western Heat Dome of 26 so historic?
I go into it in my blog post, but there's a background. There's been a shift that favors ridging. What's happened is the leading mode of winter atmospheric circulation over North America has changed. There is a pattern that started emerging. It's called the North American Winter Dipole, and there's a ridge over the west in a trough over the East Coast. It's warm and dry out here and cold and snowy in the East. And we saw it, you know, that ridge was there intermittently all winter. And, you know, it was like we had two different winters on the western U.S. and the eastern U.S.
I never got to use my snow shovel here. I live also in the West, and it was just hardly like a winter at all. Look, I want to start with your first post. It was on March 17th, and it asks sort of, why did this crazy heat dome happen? And the answers aren't simple, but they're not impossible either. But I did have a stumbling block in your first post title. It says, "The diabetic heat engine behind March 2026's record-shattering Western heat dome." I looked up the word diabetic, but Google automatically substitutes diabetic, the disease. That's what happens. So what does diabetic mean?
Diabetic is heat that's added from an external source. And so the big one in this story is latent heat. When water vapor condenses into rain, that releases energy into the surrounding air. That's the engine. So in this case, a storm brought in, an atmospheric river brought in warm, moist air in the northwest upstream of that ridge. And the moisture condensed and released heat that shaped the pressure field of the atmosphere downstream. And they contrast diabetic with adiabatic, which it just air changes temperature just because of pressure changes. That's like more simple summer ridging. You have a high pressure ridge and it gets compressed by the weight of the atmosphere above it, and compression warms it. But the extreme ridging we saw was because that ridge was getting pumped by this external heat source from this atmospheric river.
Yeah, I think your first blog post revealed, for me at least, a common misunderstanding about how we are changing the climate. We think the sun's rays bounce around in the air and that's why it's getting hotter. But it turns out we are changing the way water works in the atmosphere. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, as the planet warms, the atmosphere holds more moisture. In this case, there was a lot of moisture in the air over Hawaii. So all that moisture got transported up to the northwest, where it condensed into rain, releasing a whole lot of heat. And the background story is that there was more moisture in the air because of global warming. So that heat pump had more moisture in it to pump the downstream ridge.
This heat dome kind of happened before in 2021, but that was at the end of June. I lived through it. I was plastered to a couch in a place with no AC. It wasn't easy. So we had hundreds of people killed in British Columbia. Since then, we've developed science on that. Deirdre, what do we know? Is that another example of what just happened this year?
So I have to give credit to Claude AI, Anthropics Claude, because I didn't make the connection with the precipitation upstream. I was going over the atmospheric patterns with Claude, and I know that there's, you know, a nonlinear amplification. But I mostly knew about warming of the land. And Claude said, there's an atmospheric river pumping it upstream. And I'm like, and I go look, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, right. Claude just did pattern matching. And so then I said, well, let's pull the literature. And Claude did a literature search. And I'm like, we have published this book. You know, help me with a blog post. Because you could see the very clear and specific mechanism laid out in this series of papers on the Pacific Northwest. And yeah, it describes what happened. And so what was really helpful about AI, it's not directly an attribution, but this allowed journalists to start, you know, connecting with scientists, and scientists read it, and so it provides sort of an instant connection with the literature. And that's what previously took a lot of time, is you'd have to wait for a scientific publication, which could take a year or more.
We will be right back with Deirdre Desjardins and Regime Shift in the Atmosphere.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Deirdre Desjardins previously did research on nonlinear dynamics and complex systems theory at the NASA Ames Research Center, at the Center for Nonlinear Studies, Los Alamos, and the Santa Fe Institute. Now she's here with the analysis of strange weeks of summer in March and the long drought in the American West. Her two blog posts, loaded with scientific references, have drawn national attention. Let's continue. Does the science suggest large heat domes will become more common as we heat the atmosphere, even just by a degree more than today?
So we've already seen that. And Stefan Ramsdorf, who's a German scientist who did work on the possible shutdown of the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC, it's a big, huge ocean current that transports heat. Ramsdorf and other and Robinson and others note that, you know, the incidence of 3 and 4 standard deviation events has increased spectacularly. We're seeing a lot more ridging and a lot more extreme events. This is something that scientists have been seeing for a while, but it's been more in summer. And that's associated, there's actually a shift in the planetary wave structure that they think happened, and they think that the atmosphere is preferentially creating these ridges, and they're lingering for longer because they're part of a planetary standing wave in the atmosphere. And one of the things that happened, I saw the 500 millibar height is how high that is whether you have a ridge or a trough. And so I looked at the pattern, and I look at it focused on the Arctic, and I'm like, there's 5 lobes. It was very clear, except there was this big ridge partly over the ocean that was kind of distorting one of the lobes. I'm like, wow, this looks like wave number 5, and we know that from research that wave number seems to be more preferentially favored. It's changing, and part of the reason is the jet stream is shifting north, and the jet stream runs into the Alaskan Ridge now more often. And the Alaskan Ridge bends the jet stream when it hits it. So that's one theory. There's multiple theories about why we're seeing it, but that's what's happening in winter. And it favors these wave number 5s. So I saw that and I went, wow. And, and I thought, well, let me look at it with Claude. And Claude and I looked at it, and we tied it to the literature. And then Claude actually made the link with, that still didn't explain why it was amplified so much. And Claude made the link with the atmospheric river coming up from Hawaii. So then we linked in all of these core mechanism papers on the ridge amplification in the June 2021 Pacific Northwest. And I wouldn't have made all those links myself. I read very broadly, but still more than one human can really do quickly.
Yeah, it's kind of like hiring some really good science researchers. I mean, you have to go and figure it out for yourself once you get those links. And I also find, though, that, and I see this in your blog posts, that there's the human reaction. Well, what does this really mean for me, a person with a brain? And you do that really well. In the first article, you also cover something close to your ongoing work, the impact of early heat on snowpack, and that's needed for summer water in the western states. What is the situation, Deirdre?
Oh, it's dire. So, you know, the snowpack in the Sierra has pretty much just melted with this heat dome. It's just gone. So when the runoff's that fast, we capture less of it. It's also, like, terrible for fall run Chinook salmon. Living on the California coast, you know, we had salmon fishermen in Santa Cruz. So it was a really big part of the economy in the coast north of Mendocino, the fishing economy, and the salmon fishing industry has just been hammered because, you know, there isn't the flow. The salmon smolts preferentially migrate during these pulses, and to have a huge pulse in early March, we're not going to see the pulses in April or May. So it's very bad for water supply, it's very bad for salmon, and it's bad for other stream-dependent life.
So why was the winter of 2025 and 26 split into two different versions? You had snowy cold in the east for all our listeners there, but warmer, snowless parts in the west. And we've touched on that, but is that really one event, the split?
So what happens is because of this wave guide and the jet stream hitting the Alaskan Ridge is one process. There are multiple theories about why this is happening. But when they look at atmospheric shifts, they see this North American winter dipole pattern where there's a ridge in the west and a trough in the east. It's just a lot more often. It's become the leading pattern of atmospheric variability. That's, you know, and that's what you saw. That ridge just kept coming back, and it would just park itself over the continent.
Why did the record-breaking heat and the cold in the east, why did it stay for weeks when most weather systems move on in days?
Well, the reason, again, is, and this is still an active area of study, and I haven't done a kind of attribution analysis. I'm mostly connected with the literature, but the literature shows that the old pattern was called the Pacific North American pattern, and that was a tripole, and it would shift between a high on the west and a low in the east and a low over the Pacific Ocean and a high over the North Pacific and a low over the west coast and a high over the east coast. But this winter dipole is different, and it shifted just a quarter of a planetary wavelength eastward and southward relative to PNA. And it sits over the interior west and the Four Corners Great Basin region, and the trough sits over the Great Lakes and the northeast. So the North American winter dipole, it gives you this warm west, cool east continental dipole that we've seen repeatedly all winter. There's a ridge over the southwest and the interior west, and then the Rockies is kind of a break. The atmosphere actually, the Rockies does affect atmospheric patterns. And then the trough is over the Midwest and the Northeast, and that's what we've seen repeatedly. We also saw it repeatedly. California had a terrible drought from 2012 to 2016, and we saw it, that pattern and ridges in the winter 2012 to 2013, 2013 to 14, 2014 to 2015. Daniel Swain called, we had a ridge, the ridiculously resilient ridge. This pattern where we've got the warm west, cool east, the atmosphere has just shifted, and we're seeing a lot more, and that's why we have the two winters. It's just, it's a regime shift, and that's from my, you know, nonlinear dynamics background. You know, the climate is undergoing these regime shifts, and they're not just internal variability. They're not just the atmosphere reshuffling. They're being driven by global warming.
I think a lot of us expected that the weather would change fundamentally for our grandkids, but here it is. And you emphasize, quote, the climate change connection operates through several pathways that compound rather than simply add. And I think that's probably the key to why it's coming faster. Do you want to tell us more?
Yeah, and I've actually been spending this week looking in detail at how those feedbacks are changing. So we didn't expect this, and our climate models don't capture this very well. Michael Mann and Stephen Ramsdorf and others have written a paper on quasi-resonant amplification in the summer, which causes ridges to just be parked in the summer, and climate models just don't adequately capture it. Europe has had ridges parked over it a lot in the summer and had record heat waves. We've seen it some here as well. This is slightly different because it's in winter, but there seems to be another atmospheric shift, and they're both sort of different mechanisms. When I started looking at what happened around 2013, 2014, the whole atmospheric leading patterns reorganized. And I'm like, boy, this looks like a regime shift. That's kind of the challenge, is to recognize this, because we have the climate is fundamentally nonlinear, and you have these different components like, you know, sea surface temperatures, deep ocean heat content, patterns in the atmosphere, precipitation and how atmospheric rivers, where the atmospheric rivers hit, how much moisture they're hitting. And so you have both slow changes, like the slow increase in amount of moisture. That's kind of just a long, consistent trend the atmosphere can hold. And then you have these structural shifts where the atmosphere suddenly reorganizes how it interacts with the Pacific Ocean. And that's what we saw around 2013, 2014. And we're still understanding these reorganizations.
Yes, we have to try and figure this out while it's happening, and that makes it kind of challenging. We don't yet, for example, have all the science in, hardly any science in, on what just happened with the March heat wave in the West. I think we will get that science, but do you still have fundamental questions that you would like to see answered about this?
I think there needs to be more funding for synthesis of existing research, and I think particularly with the cut by the Trump administration to scientific research and climate research. One thing I'd like to highlight is the Trump administration has proposed moving the supercomputer out of the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder and potentially closing that center. That would be devastating for the kind of research we need to understand what's going on. We need people to oppose this. Even for people, Ryan Mao is a climate skeptic on X. He's also a very good meteorologist. He was thick head of NOAA under the first Trump administration, but even he recognizes that we're shifting into a new regime. He actually really liked my blog post and said, this is great because it explained the mechanisms. So even a meteorologist who's skeptical about global warming recognizes we're in a different regime. We're in a much warmer regime than we have been in the 20th century. And we've got to understand how it's changing. And that shouldn't be political. We've got to do the modeling. And, of course, all the 99% of scientists agree that climate change is real. It's here. It's happening now. We're seeing more and more effects. And, unfortunately, that's been politicized, and it shouldn't have been. But even if you question the changes, the cause of the changes we're seeing, it is absolutely undeniable that we're seeing them. And they affect everything. They affect where crops grow. They affect ridges like this, they affect rivers and stream flow and water supply, and we've got to understand them.
Right. Nature is changing rapidly right under our feet, and we're kind of putting on a pair of blinder glasses so we don't have to look at it. And shutting NCAR, as you mentioned, would be definitely putting on the blinders. As we wrap up here, do you have any other thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners, Deirdre?
Go follow my blog, California Water Research, and I'm going to change the name to something like California Water and Climate Research, because I'm definitely starting to focus more on the climate aspect. And Daniel Swain is also really excellent on this, and he does, if you live in the western U.S., he does amazing analyses. If you live in the Jeff Berardelli, who's on X, not everybody's on X, but Jeff is amazing, and he's a meteorologist in Florida, but he really constantly produces very informative graphics about what's happening and the ridging and so on. So there are some good streams of content, you know. Yeah, I think it was a really good piece of science communication. And I also want to thank Anthropic for providing a model that can help with these kind of syntheses. I think it's going to really help.
Well, maybe as the government bails on research, we'll find more people like you and me willing to dig in and at least see what the science we've got so far is saying and translate it for everyone. And that is really the purpose of this radio show.
I'm very transparent that, no, I didn't do this all by myself.
I understand. I'm using Gemini and Perplexity as my research assistants now. I would love to have a budget where I could just hire some people, you know. But now that it's expanding our work. We have to be careful, but it is expanding it.
I think there's a Nature article that says we've achieved artificial general intelligence. And I'm like, yeah, Perplexity runs on Claude, too. And, yeah, it's really clear with Claude. Gemini is pretty smart, too. Gemini, it makes a huge difference because it's available to someone, to a journalist, right? You couldn't hire a postdoc or a grad student. I actually have like 6 Claude Opus instances right now analyzing shifts across a huge range of variables from, you know, like the troposphere and atmosphere. Atmospheric heating to sea surface temperatures, ocean heat content, circulation, ocean and atmospheric circulation patterns in the North Pacific, and heating. And it's like, it's showing these staggering shifts. And then I'm like, oh my God, why didn't anybody put these pieces together? And I was like, well, because they couldn't do all these.
Okay. Because I find this very interesting, and as I say, I'm using it too, although I have to say that some of our listeners are super critical of AI and think we shouldn't use it at all, and if we do, we're just encouraging the data centers to wreck the atmosphere. So it's a thorny subject for sure.
If you do knowledge work, AI is transformative. And what I did is I stopped using streaming, because streaming uses energy too. So I don't stream Netflix or other things like that. And they also have an energy footprint. Yeah, it's like for $200 a month, I'm on the Quad Max plan, and I can get what's essentially like 6 graduate researchers. And they'll pull climate data sets, they'll analyze them, they'll produce graphs. So can do shift analyses to find shifts. They can produce tables of all the shifts across indices. The game theory. And then they can do literature searches, like the one I just did. I mean, I do those, and I've done it by hand. But what Claude Opus did would have taken me 2 months. I'm not a specialist. And what happens is there's all these sub-areas of climate research. So Pacific Northwest mechanisms was one, and I had, you know, kind of done a shallow dive, but I hadn't done a really deep dive. I didn't know all the connections. Opus could go out there and find them. And I hooked Opus up to Site, S-C-I-T-E, and that made a huge difference. Site organizes papers by cluster, so it makes it a lot easier to to follow the research chain.
I'm going to look into that. I can't afford the $200 a month at this point, and that's why I'm using Perplexity, sort of the free version, but we'll see. Perhaps if
Claude has a free tier too, and you can use Claude directly. I like Perplexity because Perplexity is like Claude, but connected to the web. So Perplexity pulls in a lot of web search. So that might be a good pattern for the journalist. I will get into a conversation with Claude, and I'll say, well, what about this? And Claude will pull the data or go look at the literature and say, well, you know, and then they'll offer some insights, and I'll think about it, and I say, well, what about this, you know? And we go back and forth, and it's actually like I worked with some of the top research groups in the field of nonlinear dynamics and complex systems theory. I was at the Santa Fe Institute for Complex Systems when the field of complex systems theory was being founded, and I worked with Don Farmer's research group at the Center for Nonlinear Studies at Los Alamos, and it was like one of the leading centers in the world for complex, for nonlinear dynamics and chaos theory at the time. So these conversations are similar to those that I had with colleagues at those institutes. We're all in this together.
We are all in this together, so let's keep tabs of what's happening. From California Water Research, we've been speaking with the director, Deirdre Desjardins. And you can find links to her key blog articles, along with my notes and some deep dive links, all in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Deirdre, thank you for this great work. I appreciate talking with you. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. EcoShock.org.
Are we entering a summer of wildfires like never seen before? The high risk is there, with wildfires burning already in parts of America right now, way before the season starts. A new study published March 11th says climate change, even at supposedly low levels now, is turbocharging what they call wildfire weather. This dangerous change is not limited to North America by any means. A team of scientists combed through data from the last 40 years. Their conclusion, quote, "We find that the observed increase in extreme fire weather bears a clear externally forced signal, detectable at 99% confidence above natural variability, and attributable to human-induced climate change," end quote. Look for their paper, "The Emerging Human Fingerprint on Global Extreme Fire Weather." Wildfire also feeds back on the climate, making the planet warmer, and that starts more fires. For me, the greatest fast feedback comes with peat fires. Peat is a buildup of plant matter over thousands of years. On this planet, that has become a major reservoir of carbon. We advanced another step in warming with peat fires in Russia in 2010, peat fires in Indonesia in 97 and 98. That pushed that developing country into the third largest source of greenhouse gases in the world for that year. A new study published March 18th says peat fires contribute disproportionately to Siberian fire carbon emissions. Peat fires can burn deep into the ground, continuing under winter snow, and lighting up again the following spring. They are far beyond any human firefighting capability. We may soon encounter fires lasting years or decades. The only solution is to drastically slash carbon emissions as fast as we can, and we have to hope for a way to draw carbon back out of the atmosphere. Recent science suggests the best way is not another machine or spreading dust over the skies, but protecting natural sinks like the great rainforests of South America and Africa. To survive, we need to help nature, not kill it. We were always just a part of the family of life here. Look after your wild relatives. They could save us, and only they can. One final word for Australian listeners. Yes, we see you. and a place well known for wild weather this last few months has been crazy down under. Sure, Sydney had some doozy storms and strange temperature swings, but Western Australia takes the prize. They hit up to 45 degrees C heat, well over 110, and then suffered through Cyclone Narelle. The cyclone hit northern Queensland, which is kind of on the east side of the continent, bounced along the north coast all the way to the west. It struck, it appeared to be over, went out over hot seas, reformed, and came back stronger than ever. This storm lasted almost 2 punishing weeks. Imagine a hurricane lasting weeks, crossing a whole continent. The shoreline with its turtles and creatures was devastated. Then, the petrol and diesel ran out on the west coast because of the Gulf War blockage. Spare a little feeling for our friends in Australia. People in many countries are in a state of suspense. When will gas run out or get too expensive for most of us? What industries will close? What parts and food just won't show up? Is it time to stock up? If you can spend time with family and friends, that's a good thing. When the big system tries to break our hearts, we need to build community stronger. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening this week and caring about this world.
What do I hear? Echoes in the heat. 100,000 people talking with their feet.